come into the community of mercy, holiness, and health. Come and you shall know peace and joy. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Montgomery. My name is Mandy Goheen, and it is my pleasure to welcome you here today. I'm a member of the board and the Worship Associates team, and it is my great honor to see all of your faces. Just so y'all know, there is some overflow seating in the next room if we get a little too warm, or we can just scoot in and be good friends. So, what I want you to know is you are welcome here. No matter your religious beliefs or lack of beliefs, you are welcome here. No matter your age or sex or sexual orientation or gender identity, you are welcome here. No matter your citizenship or your native language, no matter your political affiliation or your relationship status, no matter your physical characteristics or state of health, you are welcome here. Whoever you are, wherever you are from, and for whatever reason you find yourself here, you are welcome. One of our traditions is lighting the chalice. It's a symbol of our faith, a symbol of the light that burns within all of us. And as visitors watching the reverent lighting of this flame in our congregation, you might be forgiven for imagining that it's a symbol originating in antiquity. The flame is among the oldest of the religious symbols, and the chalice has been associated with the communion since the early centuries of Christianity. But that's not why we light this chalice. It's a vessel that holds us in community, and the light reminds us of the justice that is in our hearts. Our opening words are from Langston Hughes, Daybreak in Alabama. When I get to be a composer, I'm going to write me some music about daybreak in Alabama. And I'm going to put the prettiest songs in it, rising out of the ground like swamp mists and falling out of the heaven like soft dew. I'm going to put some tall trees in it and the scent of pine needles and the smell of red clay after rain, and long red necks, and poppy-colored faces, and big brown arms, and the field daisy eyes of black and white, black, white, black people, and the red clay earth hands in it, touching everybody with kind fingers, and touching each other, natural as dew, in the drawn-out music. When I get to be a composer and write about daybreak in Alabama. Please rise in body and or spirit and join me in our opening hymn, which is printed in the middle of your order of service. I'm going to sing it through once, and I need all the Unitarian Universalists to shout out with me. Come, come, whoever you are.
Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper. my great honor to serve this congregation as its minister, and I want to just welcome you into this church. I have just been informed that we need to change the order of service a little bit. I know that everyone here is here because the Reverend Dr. William Barber is here. And
you're going to watch the basketball game.
No.
But you're going
to lay down.
I noticed what you're going to do.
Allow him to say, yes, please, what he has to say to us.
Yes.
Where do you want me to be? Right here? Move that. Okay. Hello, Alabama.
Hello.
Oh.
Hello from Durham.
Uh-oh, Durham. All right.
I will move this microphone into your place when you find it.
Thank you, Reverend. Bless your heart.
It is my
pleasure. Thank you. How are you? Margaret, Mandy? How are you? Thank you. I'm good.
Okay.
I'll just move that basket right there. Can you pull that? Thank you so much. It's good to be here tonight. And I wanted to take a look at that flame for a minute, because we certainly need the light of truth and the fires of justice in our world today. Now, I want to be clear tonight as we honor the great spirit of the universe, God, in all of God's ways that we meet God, that I'm not normally one that just comes in and slips out. I think people know me well enough. But we're on a tour, two-state tour. It was last night. We were in Union Hill, Virginia, where a company named Dominion, of all names, is trying to run roughshod over a black community and poor white community in West Virginia and a native community in North Carolina and running a pipeline that is unnecessary and put a compressor station in a community. They lied about the population. They know it produces carcinogens and methane. A community that's a free community was founded after the Civil War. They're just starting to find many of the slave graves. And they just want to go in and tear that community up. And the governor of Virginia, who says that he is sorry about blackface, which we really told him that's not our biggest concern in this sense. What he did years ago is grotesque and ugly. But cultural racism, signs, symbols, words, rudeness, and pictures is not really the worst racism. The fact of the matter is, if you know something about racism, you know that the policies come before the ignorance. See, folk wanted slavery, then they came up with the ignorance to justify it. And so we said to him that your greatest racism is not the picture you put on your face or the black face you put on your face 30 years ago, but the fact that you're standing with this company against this community. And if you really want to show that you don't, what you did 30 years ago is not who you are, then you don't just need to apologize for that. You need to come and stand with this community and say no to the money and the power of that corporation. Because what they are engaging in is environmental racism. And so in order to be there with them last night, we had to get up at 3 in the morning to get here for tomorrow. And I'm not as young as I used to be. Sometimes I look in my yearbook and I say, where is that boy? And then, as some of you may know, over the past weeks, I've been carrying the memory of my brother, whom I we found out had was misdiagnosed for 2 years in Georgia, where they refused to expand health care in the rural part of the state. He was misdiagnosed for 2 years with pancreatic cancer. They told him it was indigestion, different things. And then they cut him open in October for gallbladder, told him it was gallbladder and everything was fine. Well, long and short, he finally was diagnosed on December the 3rd and died on January 3rd, 46 years old. My baby brother, my only brother, the brother I prayed for when I was 8 years old, and I had the pain of having to preach the eulogy over something I prayed for. I'm still wrestling with that emotionally. And so I thank you for allowing me to step up, because between the travel and the emotion, it gets a little weary sometimes. And I'm trying to maintain some sense of rest. And yet tonight, hey, my sister, and yet tonight, I want to talk about why we can't shut down. And I don't know if it's a sermon, a lecture, or a Bible study, or a little of both. But I want to lift two scriptures one out of the ancient Hebrew and one out of the New Testament. One of them in Psalm 78, which says, the men of Ephraim, though they were armed with bows, refused to fight. They had everything they needed necessary to fight, but they turned back in the day of battle and forgot how God had led them in the past. It's one of the saddest scriptures in all the Bible to me. And then in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 39, is a text that some say Dr. King often quoted. Some say that he quoted this text the night that he and Edie Nixon was watching Edie Nixon's house be burned down. And Edie Nixon, who was not committed to nonviolence, who was a veteran of war, looked at Dr. King, some said, and said, what are we going to do now? And Dr. King quoted this scripture, Hebrews 10, verse 39, some say, we do not belong to those who shrink back unto destruction, but we are those who persevere unto the salvation of the soul. Why we can't shut down when it comes to fighting for justice, fighting for what is right. Why is it in this time we can't shut down? Why is it that we have to build out this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival? Why is it that that in 41 states now people have responded to the call, 41 coordinating committees? Why did over 5,000 people do civil disobedience from Mother's Day to June 21st of last year? Why have we had over 38 million Twitter hits? Why is it that we've had over 1 million people follow us by videos and other forms of social media? Why is it that voices like Callie and others have to come together, black and white and brown and red and yellow and gay and straight and young and old and Jewish and Christian and Sikh, and even people who don't necessarily believe in a particular faith, but they believe in justice? Why is it that right now all over the country, those same coordinating commissions are delivering demands to their state houses? Why is it that right now we're coordinating and planning bus tours in all of these states to dramatize the real national emergency? And that is 43.5% of all the people in this country being poor and low wealth. Why is it that we are having hearings and telling politicians they can come and listen, they can't talk, they need to listen to impact the people? People impacted by systemic racism and poverty and ecological devastation and the war economy and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. Why is it that in June we're going to have the Poor People's Moral Congress, the Poor People's PMAC, Moral Action Congress, and bring together over 2,000 folk from across these lands, impact the people, advocates and clergy. Why is it that we have an agenda where we're not just cursing the darkness, but we're saying what can work? Why is it that we had economists and lay people sit in the room and in a few more weeks, they will release a poor people's budget and take on the lie of scarcity with the data and the facts and the best economists in this country? Why is it that we produced an audit called The Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America 50 years after the Poor People's Campaign? And why is it that we are going into communities and we've identified every county in this country where if you had 2 to 3% of the poor people in that community to register for the movement and vote, they could fundamentally transform the electoral process in this country? Why is it that we are planning now a major poor people's assembly and mass moral march on Washington in June of 2020, right after the primaries, just before the convention, with the goal of putting hundreds of thousands of people in the street to demand that this agenda, not a left agenda or a right agenda, or a Republican agenda or a Democratic agenda, or a liberal or a conservative agenda, but a moral agenda that addresses these five interlocking injustices that are cutting at the very heart and soul of this country. Why are we doing this? Why is it that even though this government shut down, we cannot shut down? That's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. And I'm inspired tonight because 53 years ago, in this city, Dr. King gave one of his most powerful sermons that too often, when we claim to remember him, we don't even talk about. The basic title of it was, "We're on the Move Now." And right there on the steps of the Alabama State House, after Bloody Sunday, after people had marched from Selma to Montgomery, and some 25,000 people were standing there, Dr. King preached an unusually long message for a rally in the street. It was unusually long. But he felt the need to diagnose what was going on, because people were saying, why is this so hard to get voting rights in the 20th century? Why are people fighting so hard? And in that sermon, listen, because it helps us today, 53 years ago, Dr. King said this. The leaders of this movement, he's talking about in the 1800s with the first Reconstruction, he said the leaders of the Reconstruction movement began awakening the poor white masses and the Negro former slaves to the fact that both of them were being fleeced by the emerging bourbon interests. Not only that, they began to unite the Negro and white masses in the South into a voting bloc that threatened to drive the bourbon interest from the command post of political powers in the South. This is, he's talking about 1868, 69, 70. To meet that threat, he said, the Southern aristocracy began immediately to engineer the development of a segregated society. He said, I want you to follow me now. I want you to follow me through here, because this is very important to see the roots of racism and the denial of the right to vote. Listen, he said in 1868, 69, 70, 71, through their control of the mass media of that day, they revised the doctrine of white supremacy. They saturated the thinking of the poor white masses with it, thus clouding their minds to the real issues that they ought to be focused on. Then they directed the placement on the books of the South laws that made it a crime for Negroes and white people to come together as equals at any level. And that did it. that crippled and eventually destroyed the populist movement of the 19th century, where black and white people were forming coalitions together. It may be said of the slavery era that the white man took the world and gave the Negro Jesus. Then it may be said of the Reconstruction era that the Southern aristocracy took the world and gave the poor white man Jim Crow. He gave him Jim Crow, and when his wrinkled stomach cried out for the food that his empty pockets could not provide, he ate Jim Crow, a psychological bird that told him no matter how bad off he was, at least he was a white man. This is Dr. King 53 years ago. But listen, because you can hear some diagnosis that'll help us today. He said he ate Jim Crow, and when his undernourished children cried out for the necessities that his low wages could not provide, he showed them the Jim Crow signs on the buses and the stores, on the streets and in the public buildings, and his children too learned to feed upon Jim Crow, their last outpost of psychological oblivion. Why did this happen? The threat of the free exercise of the ballot by Negroes and white masses coming together is what caused the establishment of a segregated society. The aristocracy could not afford for poor blacks and poor whites to come together. So they segregated Southern money from poor whites. And then they segregated Southern Moors from rich whites, and they segregated Southern churches from Christianity. And they segregated Southern minds from honest thinking, and they segregated the Negro from everything. Listen to this last sentence. This is Dr. King standing out there. That's what happened when the Negro and white masses of the South threatened to unite and build a great society for justice. Dr. King was rooted, and he rooted what was happening, what was trying to tear apart the civil rights movement, what was trying to stop voting rights. He rooted it in the context and the contours of what had always been the strategy of those who want black, brown, and indigenous and white people to be divided. He said it's a force, a group of those who have certain economic interests. And the only way they can maintain those economic interests is not to destroy the democracy, but to cripple it. Thereby to control it, thereby to take the resources of democracy and further feed their greed. He said, and every time there is the possibility of poor whites and poor blacks forming a coalition for justice, this division takes place. My friends, I think we ought to hear that again today.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. 53 years later. We need to understand the history behind some of the things happening in our midst, and through the lens, understand why we can't shut down this movement now. Let me give you one example. A couple of years ago, we passed, well, we didn't, the extremists in the Congress passed a $2 trillion, almost $3 trillion tax cut, right? Now, the lie that was told is that we're going to cut taxes for everybody and it's going to spur economic growth. Now we're finding out that the companies just took the money that they got and began to purchase their own stocks. That's what we're finding out now, right? But we were told $2 trillion. Now, most people that did the analysis didn't stop and say, first of all, $2.5-3 trillion transferred from the working class and poor folk to the wealthy and the greedy, not just the wealthy, because some folk are the wealthy, not greedy, they're conscious, but to the greedy, is more money that was transferred from the backs of slaves to the slave master. Nobody stopped and said that, thought for a minute. And it puts at risk all of the major programs that help mostly poor whites. Think about that. But they got away with it. This movement is calling it out. $2.1 trillion puts health care, puts Social Security at risk. $2 trillion, no discussion on living wages, even though there's 62 million Americans in this country who make less than a living wage every day. $2.1 trillion. And right here in the South, there are 52.7 million poor and low-wealth people, and 25,000 of them are white. The number of poor in the 13 former Confederate states is more than a third of the total number of poor in the country. The number of poor whites in the 13 Confederate states is more than a third of all the poor white folk in the country. How do you get, and yet the majority of the people that get elected from the South to go to the Congress voted in support of a $2 trillion tax cut that's going to hurt the very people that look like them? What lie can cause you to vote against your own self? There are 13 million uninsured people in the South. Where did this tax stuff come from? 45% of the people in Alabama are poor, low income. 53% of all the children. 47% of all the women. 60% of people of color. 976,000 people of color in Alabama are poor. But watch this. Percentage-wise, only 37% of white people in Alabama are poor, which is 23% less than the percentage of black people. But the 37% of white people that are poor is 200,000 more in real numbers than the number of black folk. And the income of the top 1% in Alabama grew by 113% from 1979 to 2012, while the income of the bottom 99% increased by 9%. Who sold this lie, particularly in the South, that cutting taxes for the greedy is somehow going to help poor folk in the South? Well, let's look back a little bit, and you'll understand why we can't shut down. In 1867, the radical then Republicans had built, this is a Lincoln Republican, had built power necessary to ensure the passage of the Reconstruction Act to create a process for readmitting Southern states back into the Union. There were also, as we began to see, the passage of the 14th Amendment, 1868, the 15th Amendment. 14th Amendment was equal protection under the law for all persons, not citizens. Equal protection under law for all persons. If your person is just on soil, you don't have to be a citizen. You ought to be afforded equal protection under the law. 1870, the 15th Amendment. 1870. Many of the Southern legislatures between 1868, 69, 70, like in Alabama, had large black constituencies and poor whites working together because poor whites had figured out that they had been fleeced by slavery too. That the wealthy, greedy, racist aristocracy had used them too. And so after slavery, many poor whites and blacks, former slaves and free issue blacks, began to get together. They developed something called the Freedmen's Bureau and Freedmen Hospitals. And those hospitals treated poor whites, blacks, former slaves, and free issue blacks, and provided schools for the same. Well, around 1869, the former planters began to try to come back. They founded the Klan, to first intimidate white people, not black people, to try to get black white people to stop working and voting with black people. Then they also used it against black people to keep black people from voting across the South. Then, in the midst of Grant's election, Ulysses Grant, in 1873, there was a depression in the country. Now, it was a bad depression. It lasted 6 years. Bad depression. By this time, many also had spoken against the so-called 40 acres and a mule that Sherman had promised to the former slave. The depression came primarily because of what was happening with the railroad elites, who kept gambling on the expansion in this country. This is a different kind of sermon. I'm trying to teach something here. In 1875, the Civil Rights Act is passed, which made it a felony to discriminate. And there was conversation about Frederick Douglass running for vice president. Y'all hear what I said? This is 1800. In 1877, there was an election of Rutherford B. Hayes, and he didn't win the popular vote. So he went to the southern states and asked them for their electoral college votes, and said that if he was given the electoral college so that he could have the presidency, he would give them the Supreme Court. And he would give them the troops being moved out of the South that was protecting black voters. And he would give them tax cuts to help the railroad elites that had wasted all this money, but also so that the government would not have the money to fulfill the post-slavery promises. And ever since then, tax cuts has been a code word for certain forms of systemic racism. I wish I had, as I was saying, I wish I had a witness here. Huh? You see what I'm saying? There's a history to this stuff. It didn't just happen. It didn't just come along. Right? He gave, and the tax cuts were tied always to shutting, feeding, and restoring the greed of the greedy. In other words, when they would make mistakes, the tax cut is a way of us paying them back for their craziness. But also it is tied to, in the South, a way of cutting programs, because the depressions were always blamed on the money going to poor folk, particularly black folk, and not blamed on the railroad elites and the others. So the lie in the South was to the, as Dr. King said, to the segregated South and to the white folk, was that if, in fact, we cut these taxes, your lives will raise up because your life is bad because us giving this money to these so-called former slaves is what's causing the depression in the first place. Oh, I got a witness over here. She said it's good. Now, the shutdown. We just had a shutdown, right? And everybody thinks the shutdown is over the wall. Lord have mercy. So I got a researcher on my staff named Clinton, and he did some research. I'm always at do something. And we found out something. In 1979, despite all of the attempts of the Klan, it's good. All of the attempts of the Klan and others to shut down black and white folk voting together in the South. Because remember, Dr. King said, when that happens, you can change the country, not just the South. And Dr. King said, every time a movement produces rooms like this, look around. After a while, somebody up here decides, you got to shut that down. You can't have that happening in Alabama and North Carolina and Mississippi, because if they ever get together, see, it's 54 million of them in those 13 states. Now, and if they get together, Callie, if you and that sister right there get together and more of you all get together, then the extremists can't win. And there are certain folk that fund the extremist campaigns because they know, just like Rutherford B. Hayes, if they can get them elected, they'll give them their tax cuts. And they'll give them their Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will then make corporations more powerful than people. Y'all don't hear what I'm saying? That's the game. That's the game. So in 1879, you still had these powerful blocks, right? And the power of the black and brown vote was still strong. And messed around in 1879, and a black man became the leader of the United States Senate. His name was Blanche Bruce from Mississippi. He became the leader of the United States Senate. Remember, I told you earlier, folks were already talking about Frederick Douglass possibly running for president, and it was possible if black and white folk kept voting, and if black people could vote without hindrance. So the historians say the first shutdown was in 1879. Now, they claim that the first shutdown was over the rider wars. In other words, when the South wanted to put riders on certain bills. And that's partially true, because the South wanted to control how federal dollars could be spent to make sure they weren't being spent in the communities of former slaves. Lord have mercy. They also wanted to eliminate the authority of the president to send troops to protect the elections in the South. And when they couldn't get those riders passed, they shut the government down. Until they were able to get them passed. And Hayes, who was their puppet, he vetoed all of the appropriation bills. And without the appropriation, the funding for enforcement acts, the funding for education, the funding for the protection of voting rights was all denied. So the government shutdown of 1879 is the first response to racial reconciliation. The government was shut down because of the power of black and white people voting together. If you know this history, my God, by 1879, you had 2,000 black men in the public office. You had diversification in the government. The government was shut down to block and to stop. Now, the historians sometimes say, Eric, that the compromise was over funding the military. Just like they're telling us the shutdown is just over the wall. But the first shutdown was a carefully designed coup d'etat in the fight for voting rights, no matter what the cost. And it might be, as Clinton and I were talking about, that 150 years later, we had a government shutdown, and that government shutdown that Donald Trump led is about more than just the wall, because the wall is about more than just the wall. The wall is really about the changing demographics in America that are producing a new electorate, huh? And the possibility of shifting politics in the South particularly. And so the shutdown is a power play. It is to send a signal. It is to try to stir up. You say, Reverend Barber, well, what you talking about? Well, see, look at what we saw on Election Day 2018. 1.4 million former felons get their right to back to vote. Colorado and Michigan voters forced the redrawing of their gerrymandered congressional map. Same day voter registration is passed in Maryland. Down here in the South, we saw that the South is no longer a solid South. We saw what's coming in Florida and in Georgia, and you all showed us the way 2 years, a year ago, with a Senate race. And that's scaring the bejesus out of some folks. We see what's happening right now, that there is this shifting happening. And the oligarchs and the racist oligarchs are worried about their ability to control the vote. They blocked fixing the Voting Rights Act. Now people are talking about it's time to fix that. They've been blocking fixing the Voting Rights Act for over 2,060 days this past week. 2,059 days longer than Strom Thurmond blocked the Civil Rights Act of 1957. And since that time, you've had 26 states pass voter suppression laws. We know that we just came through an election, a selection, where just like in 1877, the person that won, didn't win the popular vote, was selected as president. Huh? Right? He won the possibility of being selected by winning in 80,000 votes in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. He won Wisconsin by 30,000 votes. There's documented 250,000 votes suppressed in Wisconsin. He won Michigan by 10,000 votes. 100,000 African Americans didn't even vote in Michigan, in Detroit alone. More and more, the stats are telling us that the southern states are not really red states. They are disconnected, disorganized, and racially voter-suppressed states. So there's a fear. They see the possibility of Latino and immigrant folk connecting up with poor white folk and poor black folk and working class white folk and working class black folk. And if that happens, we already know if we didn't do a thing by 2042, America is no longer a majority white country. It'll be 33-33-33. And if we are organizing, we can speed that up. And all you have to do is change two or three southern states, and the whole political map in the country shifts. Yeah. See, right now, even Democrats have been foolish over the years, and I'm not part of them, independent. They've been giving up the South and not fighting. And when you give up 13 former Confederate states, you give up 171 electoral votes, which means you only need 99 from the other 37 states to win. Anybody take that bet. But if we start, and it's not going to come from the party, but if we, in a movement, black and white and brown and red and yellow together, began to organize and build movements and register people for the movement who will vote, it's not like it's a whole lot, it's just a few percentages. It's not like you got to get 20% more to vote. If you just register 30% now, the unregistered black voters in the South, and connect them with progressive whites and Latinos already here, nothing else. You could turn North Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, and Texas, and possibly Mississippi, and sure enough, Virginia. And we don't hear people talking about this. The shutdown was trying to shut down that, trying to distract us from the possibility. It's not just about a wall. It's about the political future of this country. Because we are smack dab in the middle of a burgeoning third reconstruction of America. And the question is not, do they realize it? Do we realize it? God said in Psalm 78 that the Ephraimites had everything they needed to win but refused to fight. We look at what's going on. The demographics are shifting. New data tells us, and Teresa, no, I believe in data. I believe in emotionalism that's verified. Where's Karina going here tonight? Karina, where are you at? You ain't here tonight? There she is. That's Karina going. Give her a hand. Karina, down here with us. See, I get mad when folk come here and say, Reverend Baba, you sure were inspirational. I said, I get a little offended at that because ain't no real inspiration without information. Because anybody that just can inspire you but doesn't have any facts and figure to back it up, that's like a bad case of heartburn. Let me tell you something to make you happy and understand why we can't shut down, Callie, this movement, and why eventually some people are going to try to divide us and make us shut it down. The South is at a moment of great demographic shifts because of African-American remigration and Latino and Asian immigration. The population of people of color in the South has exploded in recent years. From 2000 to 2010, the non-Hispanic white population grew by 4%, but the so-called minority population grew by 34%. Now, those who don't believe in the beloved community, they are scared of that. But folk in the Universalist Church ain't scared of that. And those of us in the poor, because we know that's the possibility. In 2000, the South was 34.2% people of color. And that number jumped by 40% by 2010. That's what all this voter suppression is about. That's all this wall building is about. They see it. They see that those of us who believe in justice have everything we need to win if we fight. Huh? Huh? They understand that African Americans have for some time now been the backbone of the progressive vote. They have witnessed how increases in African American vote, boosted by increases in the Latino vote, connected to the progressive white vote, particularly poor and working class, can flip states and change the entire map. It's right here. That's why out of the 13 southern states historically considered the Black Belt, 9 passed strict photo ID laws and 11 passed restrictions that were meant to limit the power of the African American vote, Latino. Why? Dr. King said it. Because every time there is the possibility of poor whites and poor blacks coming together and shifting the nation and building a great society, division is sown. That's why we have a divider in chief. And that's why you can't just focus on him. He is not the problem. The problem is those that pushed him in, his enablers, and who made a deal with him. If we'll let you in, give us the Supreme Court. Give us the tax cuts. give us the continual lies about voter fraud and suppression. And he, because, and they let him in because they see their last chance to continue to control the nation and control the South is on the horizon. They're trying to curtail the vote because they see what has happened. So the reality is, as I close, these southern states and Alabama, once again, that's what you're being called. And that's why some of you in here tonight that's got gray hair, you're being called to suit up one more time. And some of you that colored your hair, but it's still gray, you're going to call to suit up. And I ain't just talking to the women either. And some of you that are living off the sacrifice of others, you're being called to suit up for the first time. And some of you that are young enough to go to work and to go where these other folk point you, you're being called to suit up. Because in reality, the southern states are not red or blue. That's CNN, MSNBC, Fox talking points. The reality is the southern states are unorganized, undermobilized, voter suppressed, and intentionally divided states. Because the extremists know that the poor hold the key to the transformation of America. And not just America. You see, when this thing flips, America will be the first liberal democracy of its kind with the money power where black and brown and progressive white folk elect the leaders. And that is a threat to white nationalism across the world. Because the world has never seen that in modern times. A major liberal democracy with people electing the folk and the people electing them come up from the people that have been traditionally suppressed and oppressed. And they elect people that believe in the beloved community and believe in the moral arc of the universe. That becomes a threat to the white nationalism and white supremacy around the world. And the problem with white nationalism and white supremacy is white nationalism and white supremacy doesn't even like white people. See, white nationalism votes against health care. You can't love white people if you vote against health care when the majority of the people that need health care are white. You can't love white people if white nationalism will vote against living wages because they argue that it's basically a bunch of lazy folk that's going to get the wages. And they vote against Medicare, Medicaid. Their argument is somehow those folk are going to get some free stuff. Right? They vote against those things. That's what white, there's a guy by the name of, he's a white supremacist. I think it's Richard Spencer, right? The white supremacist. He said he knew Trump was his man, the way Trump came out against Latino people. And he said in one of his writings, you know, he went to Duke for a minute. He actually said that we can have health care in this country, but we first got to make it a white country. And until then, we can't have universal health care. He said, I believe in universal health care, but I don't believe in it until, right? So white supremacy doesn't even like white people. Because white supremacy is built on a lie, and it's the lie of hate, and it eventually is a hate of humanity, right? You can't say you for white people when you vote against programs to help the poor, when the fact of the matter, there are 140 million poor people in this country, and the majority of them are white. And women, and white children, and unemployed or disabled white people. Now, percentage-wise, there are more black people poor within that race. But in terms of raw numbers, there are 40 million more poor white people than there are poor black people in raw numbers. White supremacy is just hatred, and it's rooted in a lie. And as my grandmama used to say, if you scratch a liar, you find a thief. And if you look at this past election, 100 million people didn't vote. 100 million people. Even in these southern states, upwards of 40 and 50% of black and white people didn't even vote. We don't really know who's got elected because we've never really had a full-fledged electoral turnout. And the extremists bet on that. They love that. And part of the reason we don't have a turnout is not what the extremists are doing, but because even Democrats and other progressives over the years have stopped talking about poverty and really dealing with racism. I'm trying to want to deal with racism when somebody get caught with a picture. That's real racism. It's systemic, policy driven. And it hurts everybody. But there are 140 million people. We had 25 presidential debates in 2016, and not one debate was on poverty, even though 43.5% of the people in this country are poor. How can you not even talk about it? We had less voting rights in 2016 than we had in 1965 because of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. Not one debate from the electoral politics on voting rights. 37 million people without health care. We're the only country of the 25 wealthiest countries that does not provide some form of universal health care. We are the key in this movement to shifting that narrative. That's why we're having these hearings. That's why we're going to have this Congress. That's why we're going to have a mass moral poor people's assembly and march on Washington with hundreds of thousands of people, because we must change the narrative. And we must let people know, particularly poor people and advocates for poor people and religious leaders and even people who have faith but don't have faith but they believe in the moral arc of the universe, that we have everything necessary to win. But we must fight. We must come together. We must stand together. And we must decide that we are not of those who shrink back unto destruction, but we are those who persevere unto the salvation of the soul. Because faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor, I'm the evidence of what's coming. Because the soul of America is in trouble. But if we all get together, black folk, white folk, brown folk, red folk, yellow folk, Alabama folk, Mississippi folk, California folk, North Carolina folk, Louisiana folk, Florida folk, Nevada folk, if we all get together, and I'm here to tell you, in this movement, we're all coming together. All over the country, the Apache Nation is coming together. Poor white folk from Washington State are coming together. Black and white folk from Alabama. White folk from the mountains of Tennessee and Kentucky. Folk from California was up talking today to folk from Connecticut. All of them are coming together because we've decided that the one thing that will not be written on our tombstone is that we had everything necessary to win, but we sat down and did not fight. I have one question. Is there anybody still willing to fight for justice? Is there anybody still willing to fight for the beloved community? Is there anybody still willing to believe that things don't have to be this way? Then lift your hands and say, sign me up. Sign me up. I'm on the battlefield for my Lord. And I promise him that I'd serve. My brother died. But as he was dying, he looked at me in my eyes and said three things to me. that I promised I'd tell everywhere I go. He said, Billy, that's what we called each other. He was chucking out Billy. He said, Billy, I love you for everything you've ever done. Billy, I thank you for being my big brother. But thirdly, he said, I wanted to march with you. I had planned this year and next year to be with the Poor People's Campaign. But it looks like I'm going home. But tell the folk, don't stop marching. Don't stop fighting. And I'll be leaning over the battlements of heaven, waving you on. We are not of those who shrink back unto destruction, but we are those who persevere unto the salvation of the soul. And that's why we can't shut this movement down yet. God bless your heart. Bless your heart. Thank you, Pastor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alabama helped us have this event here tonight. And so we want to support them. Now, I am not fooled. I know you did not come out tonight to come to a Unitarian Universalist worship service. And I am not going to inflict one upon you. We had some powerful testimony up in here tonight. We heard the voice of a prophet. And I do not want to take any of that energy away. I did have some things planned for us here tonight, but what we're gonna do right now is express our gratitude to the Poor People's Campaign of Alabama. These folks have been working for 3 years now, mostly invisible to virtually all of us here, but they have been working tirelessly to bring about the change that we so desperately need. There are people all across Alabama who live in poverty, who live without. I talk to people right here in Montgomery who do not have safe running water in their homes, who can't get their children or their parents to hospitals or get the medications for them that they need. Every day I have those conversations, and the Poor People's Campaign of Alabama is working to change that, to awaken the moral conscience of our elected representatives and to bring about that revival that we so desperately need. So what we're going to do right now is pass the baskets. I'm going to ask you to consider what you can do to support this desperately important work that's happening. Please share what you can, and we're going to sing as we pass the baskets. And my friends, I cannot sing. So I'm going to...
I can't either.
The Poor People's Campaign. Carolyn? Is that right? The Poor People's Campaign of Alabama?
That's right.
That is right. The Poor People's Campaign of Alabama is how you should be making out your checks. And what we want to sing now together is a song that is a hymn of Unitarian Universalism. It is our prayer that we as a congregation sing together every week. Spirit of Life, the words are printed in your order of service.
All right, Unitarian Universalists, help me out. Are we ready? Okay.
Has everyone had an opportunity to contribute? I don't want to cut this short now. I want to thank you for coming. If you're interested in what it is that we do here, there is information in the literature rack, and there are cards on the front desk where you are invited to give us your contact information, and we would love to be in touch. We meet here every Sunday morning at 10 a.m., and like Mandy read in the introduction this evening, we are not concerned with who you are, where you come from, anything about your background, or we are not concerned here with theology. We are concerned with being in love with one another, in community as human beings. And I thank you all for coming and being here with us tonight. I hope I see you again soon. God bless you.